Thomas Coffee Metal Podcast, episode 80.
Welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. I'm your host, Don Cardenas, and this episode is going to be a little different than our usual episodes. Because I am an expert at time management, I am not going to have time to do my usual separate segments of recommendations for comics and coffee and metal before the guests. So we're just going to lump it all into one. And yeah, it's going to be a fun time. So let's get right to my guest. From directing music videos for Metallica and Monster Magnet to being a live music photographer to his own awesome comics, which we're going to talk about a whole bunch, I am incredibly pleased to have Bill Mucci on the show. Bill, before we talk any I told you I was going to mess it all up myself. Trying to lump all this into one.
You're doing fine, Don. And I'm really enjoying myself. Thank you for having me.
You would think this being the 80th episode, I would not be this ridiculous about it, or maybe write this down beforehand, but no, that's not how we do things. So anyway, and this is gonna stay in the show because I don't have time to edit this, and who really cares? Everyone can just laugh at my stupidity, it's fine. But before we talk about all that awesomeness that you got going on and you've done, Phil Mucci, Comics Coffee Metal, what are you digging right now?
Well, in terms of metal, you know, I was kind of behind, and I just with All Them Witches latest album. It's not even brand new, but I really am really digging it compared to it's called Nothing as the Ideal. It's their last album, but I think it's from 2020. Anyway, it's really a great progression for the band. I've liked all their stuff. I never loved it, but this is like really advanced stylistically to sort of a progressive metal psychedelic rock plateau that okay. I'm really digging a lot. I don't think that's a unique point of view. I think a lot of people really like that album. I'm really into kind of like stoner doomy type metal a lot of the time, especially for writing and things like that. So that's
it is fun stuff to work to for sure.
Yeah, because there's like the like things that are too lyrical or too clear become distracting when I'm writing or doing, you know, like if I'm coloring, I can listen to podcasts, I can listen to anything, you know, or have news up, whatever. But writing, there's that part of the creative output. Music is key to it, you know, as it is to, you know, to me. As it is to a lot of artists, me is like that type of music can put me in the right mood. I tend to make lists like, you know, it's bands that are basically inspired by Black Sabbath or bands who think Black Sabbath plays too fast. You know, they just slow it all down. You know, they consider Black Sabbath speed metal, so they just slow it all down, buzz it all out. And
tune it a step lower.
That they had a new album come out over COVID that I didn't get, and then I just got that, so I'm listening to that too. And one other one that I just discovered because I like Windhand, which is a female vocalist over fuzzy guitars and doom, is King Woman.
It's a good combo.
Have you heard of that band, King Woman?
No, I've heard of All Them Witches and Windhand, but not this one. No.
Yeah, King Woman is like, it's kind of like Chelsea Wolfe meets Windhand. It's a female vocalist, but it's this really reverby kind of distant sounding, echoey, with really fuzzy guitars and really emotional like rhythms. It's really cool. I think they have like two albums, but I just started like listening to them this week on Bandcamp, and I think I'm going to probably buy both their albums. It's just unique sounding, you know, and it puts you in a mood. It's very dark, moody, and, you know, total horror movie kind of vibes that I get from it. Because I'll make a playlist of like all sludgy horror sounding metal or electronic you know, that reminds me of like a John Carpenter movie and a lot of John Carpenter music sometimes for writing, you know, depends on what the story is.
Yeah. No, yeah.
You know,
yeah, you I really like that kind of
together in your head and then you put that together and you can, it helps you just write through entire, you know, I got 2 hours to write. I'm going to put on the playlist and, you know, turn everything else off kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, definitely. You know, bands of that ilk they're really great to work to. You know, I like that kind of stuff. I think I would tend more towards the, maybe not super slow kind of doomy stuff, but you know, I like stuff like Bloody Hammers and of course Sabbath and all that. And that kind of just overly fuzzed.
Yeah.
And you mentioned with female vocals, like that's like such a great combo, like that I wouldn't have expected, I guess, when I first started getting into this kind of music.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you have, I don't know, but then it kind of makes sense because, you know, Ozzy's kind of up there a bit, you know?
Yeah.
His range isn't, you know, ultra masculine. So
well,
it's like,
when I first heard like Windhand, I couldn't even tell it was a woman because I thought it was like a falsetto or like a higher pitched vocal guy who wasn't doing the Cookie Monster voice. They're just doing that distant, yeah, you know, kind of reverby sound. But like Uncle Acid and the Deadbeats, I don't know if you listen to him at all. It's not metal as much as it's like really hard rock, 70s style hard rock. And he has a very high voice, but he puts all these effects on it. I recommend them as well because I heard that the first album was like 10 years ago now, but now he's touring all over the place. Really, really awesome music. Very like catchy, great guitar solos, all occult themes, all very, you know, old school 70s vibe to it. But I mean, you might like All Them Witches more because it's not as doomy. It's more progressive. If you know the band, you know the band Elder, out of Boston.
I know of.
Yeah, they're also. I know of them. They started as like a real stoner doom kind of band with songs that had like Conan clips in them, like literally from the movie. you know, they had like Riddle of Steel was one of their tracks, and now their stuff is
nice.
Like they've gotten so advanced. They come out with an album every 2 or 3 years, and they each are. This amazing progression. Now they're like this progressive metal, like insane outfit. They're like Yes, but with metal, and you know, lots of harmonies and like really crazy song constructions that, you know, you get the riffs that you want, and then it just kind of branches off like a Yes song into like a whole other song and then comes back to the riff.
Mm-hmm.
It's really okay. Interesting stuff. But they were one that I cool. like started listening to because I read about them. And then I just kept picking up their albums and they just kept changing. Wow, this is really amazing. They're one of those bands, like they've gotten so good, like nobody's going to they're probably not going to be that popular, but they're really amazing. Mm-hmm. Like the albums are like reading a novel, you know, it's that dense. Mm-hmm. The music is that dense and you kind of like, it's great headphone music. Like I'll put on my coffee in the morning. Speaking of coffee, you know, I get up early, I put on a pot of coffee, and I go for my walk with headphones on. And that's how I listen to like albums like that, where, you know, if you go on a nice long walk, you can listen to the whole thing, and it's like a journey, you know, sonic journey. But it's not like typical metal that you hear. That's why I don't even, the labels get away from me sometimes, but I would say it's like, you know, progressive rock.
Yeah, it's been well established on the show, I think, that the label thing with bands, and especially metal bands, like it's hard to be even like remotely accurate anymore. Metal is definitely a medium as opposed to a genre at this point. So, you know, I made this joke on Twitter before. It's like, you know, I love metal because it just takes every other, like, and whenever you incorporate another genre into it, it's just like, here, we made this better.
Yeah. No, I was having a discussion about, you know, like, like when I was younger, my dad turned me on to like classical music first and movie scores. And when I first heard metal, I heard the classical music that in it, because riffs and things like that, those are part of classical music as well. Riffs and themes, you know, combined with melodies. You know, there's the percussive sort of music. And to me, it was very similar. But in the last conversation I had with somebody about it, they're like, what? Classical music? Oh, man, come on. Let's talk about metal. I'm like, some of it's very metal. I'm sorry. It's this, just replace it with guitars and, you know, you're going to have the same riff.
Oh, yeah. There's the huge overlap with metal and classical music. And it's, you know, it's, as someone else put on another podcast I listened to, Thrash It Out, which is a great metal podcast. The Anthony Johnston was the co-host, was basically said, you know, metal and classical music, you know, they share the drama.
Yeah, they know? Do.
That intensity and that drama.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's you know, listen to Ride of Valkyries and try, you know, tell yourself that would not be a metal song. You know, like yeah, someone would not have written that.
The one that I brought up too was Holst, The Planets. He has this, you know, whole symphony, and it's each planet, and Mars, the bringer of war, or the god of war, I forget what the subtitle is, but anyway, it's this total heavy metal riff. You've heard it in movie trailers. Like, it's a famous, like, theme song, and it sound, you could make the violin part guitars and it would just be heavy metal, because it's that, like, driving, and it's just a riff, you know, that's a repeating riff. And I, you know, that's what I always liked about metal, was that it can create that mood that kind of symphonic scores can, where you can get this really overwhelming sense of drama and darkness in metal that can be transportive, you know, or it can be expressive of your own mm-hmm. sort of feelings, or, you know, and when I was a kid and I was drawing a lot, you know, like, it was like listening to a movie score and then drawing what I was seeing in my head from music, you know? That continues on in life. Like, you begin to associate more and more. And when I got really into movies too, it was like I would come out of a movie and I would really be humming score, because I'd be listening to that and realizing how that was affecting, like, how much I liked it, you know, or how much the adventure worked. And simple things, like, everybody knows, like Indiana Jones theme or something like that. You hear that and you're like, adventure, fun, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And it's just classical music, but it's in a movie, and it's Indiana Jones, and you're like, oh, wow. And you hear that theme, and it immediately transports you to that, like, that feeling, that vibe that you got, you know. And that's what I always loved about music. And that's why I said, you know, in our side discussion, that I could never be doomed to listen to one thing forever. Because I would feel like I was, like, you know, suffocating or something.
Sure. Well, you've brought up Alden Witches. Is there a song or a track you would say, like, would be the one to get someone to listen to the band, to check out?
Yes. I would say track one on Nothing as the Ideal, which is Saturnine and Iron Jaw. There's a very quiet beginning, but once the song proper starts, you get it. You get the riff. You get the harmonic vocals. It's really cool. It's, you know, it's like a 6.5 minute song, almost 7 minutes long. but it's really cool. And it sneaks up on you on a playlist too, because there's this really quiet introduction to it. And then when it kicks in, you're like, oh, right, this is that song. And you're like, totally into it. It's like, I love it when they do that. And there's like this build up. And it's the track one on the album. So it's like, it kind of lulls you in. Because a lot of times now, like, we listen to music not in album form, you know, we listen to, like, just a song or whatever, but these guys put together an album, like, in order, and it builds, and it's really good. I was surprised, because I liked their stuff, but I didn't love it, because it has a southern vibe to it. There's even a song on here that's borderline folk western rock, you know, but Saturnine and Iron Jaw is like it's just an ass kicking song.
All right, well, let's give a listen to that track, Saturnine and Iron Jaw, from Alden Witches. Lead me back to myself. We'll be right back. All right, awesome. So when it comes to metal, you know, you've mentioned like the album thing, you know, bands writing for albums, or, you know, people don't really listen to them anymore. And that's one of the positives of doing the show, is I kind of have to force myself to listen to a whole album, which is like, you know, a good thing or a bad thing sometimes.
Right.
But I've discovered a lot more stuff that I normally would not, just because I had to listen to a full album and get that whole experience, that whole vibe and all that. And sometimes it's really easy to catch on to an album, and sometimes it's a little bit more difficult. There was a band called Wage War who did their new album was called Manic, and it took me a minute, but once I listened to the whole album, like, I really got into it, and now it was probably one of my favorite albums of the last year. The album I'm going to talk about now, though, was one of those albums where, from the moment it started, I'm like, yes, I am here. And that is the album Dark Connection from Beast in Black. Beast in Black, if no one is really familiar with them, if you've heard of the band Battle Beast, this is an offshoot from them. They've been around for a handful of years, and it's very much a synth, you know, kind of, I want to say poppy metal, just like a synth kind of like dancey beat metal, but not really dancey. You know, if you heard bands like Amaranth or Battle Beast, you know, whose album I talked about recently, their latest one, it's a certain subgenre of metal where it's just a lot more upbeat, a lot more grooving and dance. I say dancey just because it has that kind of like the vibe to it, like where you can't sit still and listen to this album.
Right.
You got to be doing something. You know, it's just got a great groove going. They definitely incorporate a lot of the synth stuff. I'm a sucker for with synths and metal. When it's done well, it's like, yes, thank you. As much as I like symphonic deathcore sometimes I want some of this, you know?
Right.
But bands like this, like Amaranth or Battle Beast and all that, there seems to be a higher pedigree of them now from the early 2010s when they first kind of started popping up. And yeah, Beast in Black, they are definitely very talented, very cool. And I'll keep mine short, but yeah, this is, if you like any of those bands I've mentioned, if the description sounds like something might be up your alley, definitely check them out. We're going to give a little snippet of the song Highway to Mars, which, if you can't, you know, the opening title of this track to this album is called Blade Runner. So if you don't know what you're going to be in for, hopefully that will tell you. But yeah, Highway to Mars, it's probably my favorite track on the album so far. So let's have a quick snippet of that.
I'm Liana Kangas, and I'm actually the co-host of Comics Inebriated, a podcast about current and past events for history and weird facts about comics, pop culture. And all the while, we actually sit down with our fun special guests and have a quick drink. And one of those guests is actually Don of this very podcast. So come over, come hang out, come listen to it, and enjoy your time for the rest of this podcast.
All right, so now we've talked about metal a lot, and we're going to talk about metal a whole lot more, trust me. But just some other couple cool things we can talk about right now. And next up is, I want to say coffee. Now, you mentioned you kind of get up in the morning, you get your coffee, you go for a walk. Do you have a preference of coffee? Do you have a preferred brand, or is it just whatever?
I do. I like dark coffee. Lately, I've been into the it's not a fancy brand. It's just the organics brand. Peruvian chachamayo or chachamayo? Chachamayo, I think is how you pronounce it. And it's a really nutty dark roast. And I just have that with a little bit of half and half or splash of whole milk. And that's it. But it's like the morning is kind of my like time, you know, like before the day gets really crazed. I really love like putting on the pot, going for a walk, listening to some music, coming back. The whole apartment smells like coffee. I grab a cup, you know, I sit down, I read the news and, you know, start my day. Cause I also tend to do, like mornings are good for me for writing. So that tends to be when I'll, especially when I'm on a project, like I try to get a couple hours in the morning, you know, before I have to start answering emails and doing other stuff or running errands or whatever. I really try because I'm like kind of a morning person. I think it, like my brain is firing and fresh. And like, I can, once I start writing, I can get into it. And the walk kind of preps me. And then the coffee kind of like gives me the juice. But, I know a lot of people come on the podcast are coffee. So I think it's a great creative, you know, tool, because if I can't have it, you know, and I used to have my coffee really sweet. I used to be more of a kind of a wimp with like flavor of coffee. I would just mask it with like sugar and, you know, or the flavored creamers. But as I've gotten older and I don't want to have all that sugar either in my diet, you know, I'm a middle-aged guy. I don't need all that. I've gotten to, you know, totally unsweetened, but then you really recognize the flavor more, you know, so then you get a little bit pickier about what you're drinking because it can't just be dark thing that's really bitter, you know, it has to have other aspects to the flavor.
For sure. I mean, I've had all types of coffee enjoyers or not enjoyers on the show. So it's not, you know, not everyone has their preference to it, you know, whether they either their preference is no preference or just, you know, just the ritual of it. Like that sounds like a pretty great morning ritual. Like I get up at 5 a.m. myself. I'm not a morning person, but I have to though, cause I have 2 kids. Right. So the couple hours in the morning, that's the only, I have to carve that time out of, out of stone to have that.
Yeah.
Cause in between that and bedtime, there's no guarantee I can get anything done. So at least for now, but,
I hear you.
Yeah. So the ritual of getting up and having that coffee, like I take some half and half and a little bit of sugar. I used to think that is because I was being a wimp about the taste, but you know, I've had some really terrible coffee and you can't polish those turds with cream and sugar, you know? It's so once I started having like really good coffee, I was definitely able to, one, cut back the amount of sugar I was putting into it because I was enjoying the taste of it more. But also, you know, you recognize it. So
it stands out more, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I try not to do sugar from time to time. Anyone who's listened to the show from the beginning knows I probably had like 3 rounds of like, I've given up sugar on the coffee for now and we'll see how it goes. I just, you know, my wife can drink, she's been drinking no sugar coffee for years. And sometimes she'll even just start just drinking black again. And I'm like, I try all my new coffees black, like even just a few sips, because I want to see what it tastes like. I'm hoping for that one that'll be like, oh, I don't feel like I need to do anything to this. I'm good. You know, I have hopes that I won't be.
You don't have to prove anything to anybody.
I don't, but I do.
I don't really drink it black ever, you know, like, I'll still every now and then, if it's like, depending on when I'm having it, I will like put in a little bit of sugar or honey, like splash of honey.
Yeah.
But no, my morning coffees now is just, you know, just milk or half and half, and a splash. And it's good. I mean, I probably have 3 cups every morning. You know, like over the course of like the first couple hours in the morning. And then I don't usually drink coffee later, unless I'm on deadlines and something, and I have to, like, I'm trying to burn the midnight oil, and it's just like, oh, I'm back to the computer, but it's now 8 p.m. and I've got to go 4 hours, you know, still. Then yeah. I'll probably put out another pot.
Yeah, lately I'm about 2 cups in the morning, and then 1 in the afternoon, and then usually 1 in the evening after dinner, or now that it's nicer out, we take our kids out to the walk and go to the park, so I'll just bring a cup to go and just drink it on our walk or whatever. But yeah, it's also kind of why I drinking black coffee. Like, if I drink black coffee and I drink a full cup of it, I feel like I'm kind of done.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want more, you know? So that little bit of sweetness or whatever that comes with the half and half and the sugar is like, it keeps me coming back to it throughout the day. So.
Yeah. I think the reason I like it sweet, or I started liking it sweet, was because, like, when I was a kid growing up, I never liked, you know, coffee, or my dad was a big coffee drinker, but I liked coffee ice cream. So it was just like, oh, you know, like if you add a little milk and a little sugar, it just tastes like coffee ice cream, you know, like, and then as I got older, it was like, oh yeah, I don't want all that sugar. You know, I mean, I had a whole phase drinking those Carnation creamer things, which is basically like pouring a candy bar into your cup of coffee, which is good when you have terrible coffee. It's, you know, it masks it a little bit, but now that stuff's just, I can't even do it. It's just too sweet. It overpowers the coffee. You can't appreciate the coffee.
You know, the funny thing is,
it's still popular on sets. You know, people still love that stuff.
Yeah. It has its purpose, I think. you know, I've met my fair share of people who drink coffee just for the effects and not for the preference of taste because they want to, because, like, I kind of have to. Like, I, you know, it's either this or, you know, I get, they don't want to drink a ton of soda or whatever to get that caffeine kick. But it's funny you mentioned the coffee ice cream thing, because for a long time, like, I did not like coffee ice cream at all. But then, like, in the past couple year, like, it, probably since, you know, the pandemic, I've been, like, really into coffee ice cream now. That and peanut butter ice cream. Like, peanut butter, like, I, like, throughout the day, like, on other things, I'm like, peanut butter ice cream, give it. I don't get it. I don't get it. Why that my brain makes a distinction, but there you go. Awesome. So, you know, you mentioned the coffee you're drinking. It's the Organics Peruvian Chanchamayo. Okay, I think I've seen that in the store. I think you have Albertsons out there. Over here it's Jewel Osco. So, you know what? I think I'll have to pick a bag of that up and check it out.
Yeah, they have it whole bean, and that's how I get it and grind it. You know, it was one of those things during COVID lockdown and stuff, like the coffee. I used to get the French roast organic, which is decent, but they ran out of it, and then they had this Peruvian chanchamayo, and I was like, let me try that. And I was like, damn, this is good. I liked it better. It has more of a cocoa and nutty flavor to it.
Yeah,
that's
what
French
I like
roast.
About the dark roast. It can really have those cocoa nutty notes on there that really, even though it has the bitterness of coffee, like, that kind of goes a long way, I think.
Yeah, it does. Especially if you're not sweetening it too much or anything. Like, you really taste it in the, after you have a few sips, it's like, oh yeah, you have that, like, kind of warm, like, there's flavor to it. It's not just bitterness and caffeine.
Nice.
Anyway, no, that was a discovery. Awesome. You know, it was kind of like, necessity being the mother of invention, or the mother of discovery in this case. Oh yeah, try that. Usually I'm pretty budget, you know, conscious, so I don't go out of my way, but I would like to try more exotic flavors. But I'm also kind of like, you know, if it isn't broke, I don't tend to, like, fix it. But in this case, it kind of just worked out. It's a good one.
Well, I will take this opportunity to bring up my boys at Rootless Coffee. If you ever get a chance to check them out, and fit them into your budget, I highly recommend you check them out. It's fantastic coffee. Their damn fine cup of coffee blend is like
our main coffee. Oh yeah, you talked about that before. Yeah,
we get the 5 pound bags in, and there's another flavor they had recently that was we had an awful lot of, and kind of forgetting the name of it. But the label's inspired by the Big Lebowski, and it's really also really great stuff. And their dark roast, the dark, is amazing as well. They're just great dudes, great coffee. If you can find it in your budget to check them out, I highly recommend you do. But I also understand, like, you know, coffee is kind of our main luxury here. Like, we're not, you know, we don't really do a lot of extravagant, like, you know, going out or eating or, you know, we don't have a booze budget.
You got kids.
So, you know, yeah, exactly. So splurging on our coffee, that's our thing. Because we got kids.
Yes.
Like, yes. Yeah. No Sanka, no Folgers. There's a lot.
I have had Folgers when I've had to, but I regret it pretty quickly. Yeah. I'll actually take Folgers and put it in the grinder to make it finer so it comes out stronger. Mm. You know, like, I'll try to espresso it if I have to. But I really try not to. I mean, when I lived in New York City, I lived in New York City for a while, 16 years. Every bodega would have, I forget what it's called. Oh my God. Cafe Bustelo. It was like, yes. The yellow can. And, you know, I had that so often, and it's okay, but it's just what they have at the bodega. You know, it's not like great coffee, but I can drink anything, you know, if it comes down to it. I just have to have that coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. When it comes down to it, I can't be eternally picky. If I need the hot brown energy booster,
yeah.
That's what I'm going
to gas station say, coffee, if it comes down to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. All right, so let's talk about some comics. What comics have you been reading lately? What have you been digging comic book wise?
Comic book wise, I have really kind of been going back in time. I've been rereading Sandman, and Werewolf by Night. You know the old Marvel like horror? There was Tomb of Dracula, mm-hmm. and Werewolf by Night. Because they kind of helped me get mentally to the place where, because I'm working on the next Professor Dario Bava script right now, and I really get inspired by some of that panel and like the layouts on those pages, especially the Mike Ploog stuff in Werewolf by Night, the old, because that's like the era that I'm kind of evoking that, and I also got every Eerie comic in digital format because we were asked to like come up with some ideas maybe to pitch for a show, which we did, but it never, nothing ever happened from it. But I ended up with this whole entire run of Eerie, you know, the Warren comic horror anthology thing. So I've been also working my way through that. So I'm kind of on a retro kick right now because I'm mentally getting prepared and working on the script for the next part of, you know, Professor Dario Bava, Orgy of the Blood Freak, which I have scripts for already, but this is a rewrite to expand the story. And I love the old style, especially in the anthology books, because they really, the story compression's awesome. Like the way they, the panels, like they tell so much in like such an economy of pages. And with Mike Ploog, I love all the action with the Werewolf by Night, like the way.
Yeah,
I had, this is a funny story too. Like, I realized after I started like going through them again that I had, back when I was a little kid, I had a Viewmaster. Remember Viewmasters? They're like 3D things you look through that had a little disc in it.
Yeah.
Pictures in it, and like it's like a picture on each side that you look through like binoculars, but they light up, or you point them at light if you don't have the battery operated ones, and you got this 3D image. And they had done a conversion of some of those Marvel horror ones, and I had had them, because when I started looking at them again, I'm like, I remember seeing this in 3D. And I, you know, like, I remember, like, and it all came rushing back to me, the total, like, member berries and nostalgia buzz. And I was like, oh my God. Cause I totally recognized panels, you know, back from when I was like 3 years old or something, you know, and I had these, like, this old thing. They don't even make them anymore, I don't think. But, I mean, that'd be a cool retro thing to make, actually. What a great promotion that would be for, like, a Professor Dario Bava story. We got the Viewmaster, you know, 3D versions of all your favorite art. But, No, I wanted to go back to that stuff and the sort of 70s and late 60s psychedelic kind of horror comics, because Professor Dario Bava, one of the series that I'm working on, is definitely inspired by that time period, more the sort of European films of that time. But I also want to take stuff from that. The way the comics were done, it's the same story plot points and things, and the same type of characters, you know, in both mediums. But, you know, yeah. Like, as we were talking about before the show, like, there's a difference from, you know, filmmaking to comic book storytelling. And in a lot of ways, like, comic book storytelling is more wide open in terms of, like, budget and things like that, like things you wouldn't want to write into a script because you couldn't afford to shoot them are not off limits in a comic, you know, especially depending if you're the artist or if you're working with an artist who, you know, has a huge range, you know, like they can do monsters and people and really cool locations, and you can really get you really know that, you know, You can do a little bit more, and you can make it a little bit more extreme, and you can also focus on, like, what is the key action, what is the key moment, you know, and build narrative around that in a way that you can't do in film, where things are sort of moving and there's always motion, and you don't hold on these moments as much. But in comics, it's kind of all about those moments, so it really helps. From coming more from film, I come from photography and filmmaking first, comic books second, you know, or third, however you want to put it. And so it helps me going back. Like, if I'm trying to evoke a time period in my films, I look at those films too. If I'm trying to evoke a vibe or a time period or take people to a place in comics, I'm going to look at comics from that time in that genre and take what lessons I can from that too. Cause I think it's all transportive in the same way. We recognize that. Yeah. Like, we see it and we're like, oh yeah, that feels like this. And that's like, you know, it's like, if you want to make something old timey, you might do it in black and white instead of full color, or you might desaturate it in film, you know, in comics, you can kind of do the same thing, but with the panel art and with the layouts and how you decide to tell the story. Because the thing I don't like more about some modern comics is the decompression, you know, where it becomes more like shot reversal on conversations, and there's like too many panels for a very simple thing to happen, and it seems like it's just filler a little bit, you know, like and I was guilty of that in my first graphic novel, Professor Dario Bava, which was like too big of a script for me to start with. I ended up pages after they were already inked, which is bad. It's bad form. Cause we paid for those pages to be inked, you know, there is, and I also
learned experience
giving an artist, like, you know, on a first project, giving an artist, like, here's an 80 page script is daunting. You know, like, I've learned to like totally break things down now into manageable chunks, and I got my process way more you know, streamlined, and it was because I had a patient artist who worked with me, we had a lot of friction on the first one, but then once we worked out kind of like, oh, okay. Like once I got off my high horse as a writer director kind of guy, you know, when you do film, you're like a general in charge of an army kind of thing, you know, a small army, depending on your budget, but you know, you have heads of departments and they're responsible for this and you oversee this. And like, you basically make a lot of the decisions and, you know, direct literally many things, everything, to a certain extent. Whereas with, you know, comic books, if you're not the artist yourself, then you got to come correct with the artist. You have to understand that they're bringing, you hired them to bring their thing to it, and you can't micromanage, especially with Mike Dubish, who does Professor Dario Bava. His work is, he's all old school. He doesn't use a computer at all. So, you know, he's working on like 14 by 18 or whatever, you know, big sheets of paper, and he's pencil. Yeah. You know, once we get the pencils, he'll thumbnail the pencils, and then we'll do like he'll do a refined pencil, but that's like, that's kind of, I learned, like, that's kind of it. Like, there's not much, I can only change a few things at that. So what our process became like, my scripts are very explicit, especially for him, because he likes that detail. And then I do layout, I do thumbnails of my own, and then I provide reference documents for anything that's new in our world, because the world of Professor Dario Bava is very, there's a lot of characters that are recurring. It takes place in a lot of different locations, and it's a time period specific thing. So anything that I can provide and help him with really moves our process along. That was a very big learning experience, because I kept trying to change things, and he kept trying to explain to me like, no, the time to do that has kind of passed, where I'm already at this point. Like, I can't go into Photoshop and rearrange things. And in some cases on that first book, like I, even in post, cause I was doing the coloring and it was my first book I was coloring too. So it took me forever. That's when I realized, oh shit, there's four pages of extraneous panels I just didn't need. It's just too much. It's me thinking like a filmmaker, shot, reversal, master, you know, like not as comic book writer, where it's like, no, that could all happen in this one panel. You don't have to jumping it around. You know, there's still things that apply across both, you know, mediums. And I think somebody asked a question online about that we can get into later, but about what's the similarities, or does one prepare you for the other? And I think they do.
Well, we can talk about it. We can talk about it now. We had to put a question from John Westhoff. Yeah. You know, what's similar? Is there anything similar to writing short form videos and comics that prepared you for either medium?
And I would say definitely yes. I thought about this when I saw that question pop up, and the one thing that I think is really relevant is in my music videos, most of the time we didn't have a band. So that means in a practical sense, people are like, oh, there's no band in it. But as a filmmaker, you're like, oh, there's no band in it. I can tell the story. I can just do the story that I want to do and make this a narrative video, which is great. But the thing that you learn very quickly, especially as I also edit all of the videos, is that as an editor, you need, what are you cutting to? What's the B story? If you don't have performance, that means you have to have different narrative tracks, or at least be accelerating and compressing your storytelling to such a fast pace that you could get it across in these key scenes that are all going to be great. You know, the rule of music videos is it's just got to look awesome. You know? It's got to go to the music. Yeah. The rest of it is gravy, you know. And as a filmmaker, you want to tell a story, obviously. So I learned like A story, B story stuff, where I'm going to have this happening, but I want to be able to cut to something so I don't have to show, you know, every piece of this action. I can just give you the highlight of it and then cut to the next thing. Or there's another story that's running on a separate track to this the A story. And that is true in comics too. I find that it's true in comics, at least in mine. that I've written is that you want to be able to get to the good stuff. You know what I mean? And so a lot of times that's having an A story, a B story, you know, and a C story, so that as soon as the boring stuff is about to kick in on your A story, you cut to the B story and pick it up where the action's happening there. And then you have that implied time jump that you can then cut back to the A story later on in it to where the next bit of good shit is happening, you know? And that all helps your pacing, that helps you, you know, cut, you know, like editing is an important thing in comics too. Like when, what's going to be on that turn page, the only surprise you get in the book, you know, is when you turn that page and you got that left-hand page that you didn't see when you were turning it to there. Then you're like, oh my God, you know, that guy got killed or whatever. Or that's like a splash page where you got your amazing, insane, like full page art. You know, we have a great one at Orgy of the Blood Freaks where you flip it over and this giant monster hand is coming out of the ground and flicking a guy's head off like a dandelion. and that's a great, like, splash, literally a splash page. And, you know, but that stuff I learned as I went. And that's why, like, I was saying, like, on the first book, like, I had overwritten it and I had too many panels. And then when you're cutting them, you're like, oh, shit, you start having to sacrifice the splash page thing. So you can't just cut one page. You've got to cut because it's, you know, I had spreads in that book, too, which I've been too afraid to even try again. the next two books, there's no spreads. and it messed everything up. So it was like, oh, I have to cut an even number of pages. So then I had to go through and be like, okay, what else don't I need? You know? And I had to move panels around. It was, you know, I learned my lesson, you know, and now I break it down. You know, my script is 30 pages, but me and Mike will start with 10, start with a 10 page, you know, and it's pencils, references, you know, my thumbnails, his thumbnails. And then, you know, I'll say, all right, great. These 10 pages are awesome. Ink those. And he'll ink those and deliver them to me and I'll start coloring. And in the meantime, I've given him the next 10 pages of thumbnails and the references for those. And then we work it that way. And it's much, much more manageable and nobody gets freaked out. You know, like we set really realistic deadlines because it takes us a while because that's a lot of work. Pulling reference and doing thumbnails and then doing rough pencils, then final pencils, you know, then inks. But you get really great results that way because you've gone through it so many times, you know, like it becomes, you come up with ways to shorten it. And Mike does a thumbnail of his own that I think is like a really great idea, but it doesn't totally fit the script, I fix the script. It's not Mike's problem. You know what I mean? I'm like, okay, well, let's see if I don't need to set that up because this is going to tell you that already happened. So let's just, you know, let Mike run with that. And it's interesting too, because now I've worked with another artist on a sequential story for Gringo Loco. And that was a totally different experience, but he benefited from Mike teaching me so much in the projects we've done, because Mike and I did the first graphic novel, then we did a coloring book, and then we did the next, you know, we started the next series, and then Vicente came in to do Gringo Loco, and old, you know, wizard of comics, and I knew not to like really mess with him, and he ended up being a guy who just doesn't need anything. I mean, he took a bare bones script and just jumped in, just started handing me like, here's what I think it should look like, here's a map of the town, here's this, you know. It was really kind of amazing, and because it was something that he was really experienced with, and it's a very Gringo Loco is a very focused and smaller world in terms of like, we're not encompassing all of the late 60s Europe, you know, there's not a million monsters. Mm-hmm. It's a character story, you know, it's the journey of this one guy. And Vicente Alcazar did Jonah Hex in the 70s. He's an eerie and creepy artist. He did Vampirella, and you know, his Jonah Hex experience made it super easy for him to just like jump into this spaghetti western. Nice. You know, the supernatural spaghetti western world, and it was phenomenal. I mean, I the script I gave him was bare bones, but it was very specific in terms of like the layout of like, okay, this character's on this side of the panel, this character's here, we're seeing this, and he could take all that and just translate it, and it was like perfect. The only back and forth we had on the whole book was just designing that main, the main characters, because I had already had a bunch of Photoshop comps of how I wanted him to look, and then he took those and translated them into, you know, line art. So there was a little back and forth there, but once we settled on that, we just kept getting pages. It was really amazing. Like we were blown away and he was ahead of schedule. He finished the book a month earlier. We didn't know how long it, yeah, it was insane. We also got to see how like the old guys kind of did it. He's in his 70s, and a lot of it is like old printing techniques where he literally takes things that he's already drawn and cuts them out, puts them, rearranges them in crowd scenes. You can see it's like, oh my god, that's the same thing, but it's not Photoshop. You could see like the paper edge that flatbed scanned it with. You know, on the final inks. It was amazing because it was like, oh my god, this is, we're seeing like the technique really live here. And the art was just incredible. I was blown away. I couldn't believe that somebody got that much out of what I wrote, because it was really bare bones. But it was a thing where he read the script and he's like, I get this. I really love this. These kind of stories, they don't tell these stories anymore about these kind of anti-heroes. So he was very excited about it. So I think that helps too. If you're not the artist yourself, getting somebody else to be passionate about the project is key. You know?
Because they have to. One of the things I'm really getting from you is that you embrace the collaborative aspect of comics. And, you know, within comics, there's, you know, often the dreaded discourse of artists versus writers and, you know, who's putting in the most work and doing all these things. And, you know, the real answer is everyone's busting their ass. And the best work comes from when, you know, with very few exception, when people are working together, when you're playing to each other's strengths, when you're figuring out, you know, when writers are like, hey, you're responsible for the visual of this, I need you to be pumped about this, how do we get you pumped about this, you know? And for some people, whatever the script is as is enough for them, and other times it's like, well, you know, let's bang it around a little bit. And you know, that's kind of the fun thing about comics, and I can understand it could also be a frustrating thing about comics too, where it's like, you're used to working with someone one way, and you're working, and then you know, someone else works a different way. But I think, you know, just embracing, you know, preconceived notions of like what this is going to be. Like it's everyone has their hills they're going to die on with a story, for sure. But everything else around it, like you know, you got to be amenable to things. Like, you know, most of the time when I'm working with a writer, it's pretty much like, here you go. If you want to change something, let's talk about it. You know, and 9 times out of 10, I'm like, the most I'll do is like combine some panels or maybe even break out a couple of panels. Like, oh, yeah, it might be nice to give that an extra little beat with a panel or something. Right. And it's usually good. It's usually gravy, you know? So I've been very fortunate in that aspect. Another thing that I kind of wanted to bring up is that how much I appreciate you, you know, finding these older artists. These guys, like the thing about artists are they don't get, when they get older, very rarely do they not just keep getting better, you know, or at least at the very least know what the hell they're doing. Like, you know, granted, you know, her style is very much rooted in that, but like Ramona Freyden, you know, is like in her 90s, like doing commissions and stuff, and it looks great. It's her style, and she's still executing it perfectly, you know? And so like getting these older artists who, you know, still love their art, I would assume, and if they're still physically able to do it, like, I think, you know, a lot of younger writers or upcoming writers should really try to, you know, as much as it's like, yeah, obviously work with
the peers. I agree 100%.
Like, hey,
we're fortunate because there's, you know, a lot of them are not around anymore. And a lot of them aren't doing commissions if they are. And to find people like Emmanuel Taglietti, who's done some covers for us, and to get to work with Vicente on a sequential story, you know, a 32 page book. It's an honor because you're just eating it up. You're just learning and you're getting the benefit of all this experience. And you're like, wow, this is like, you know, I don't have to, you know, I'd already kind of learned my lesson about, you know, micromanaging or over directing. Because film is collaborative too, but you know, the director is kind of like everybody's asking them, what do you think? You know, like, is this right? Do you want this? But it's much more intimate in comics where you're working kind of one on one. And you benefit from the collaboration as a writer because it's never what you're gonna write. It's even if you write a script or if you write when you write a music video, because people don't realize that you have to write music too to get in the first place, but you know, it's never the thing that you write, it's always the result of the collaboration, it's always becoming what it's going to be, and you don't know what it's going to be till the end, when you get, even when you see the digital version of your book and it's all colored and it's all laid out and it's all lettered, getting the physical book is a whole other experience, you know, like looking at it printed and engaging with it as physical medium is a totally different experience. And you can't really tell what that's going to be. You can micromanage all you want, but if you lose the artist on your book and they lose interest, it shows and it's not going to benefit the project. So that's, you know, it all comes back to that. Like, yeah, get them engaged, listen to their opinions, let them do their thing. Let them bring their vision to it because they're just going to add. If they're passionate about it, they're just going to add to the quality of the work. The last thing you want is for people to feel like a hired gun, you know, because nobody cares about the work they're doing in that case. You want them to feel like, oh my God, this is so fun. And luckily with like Professor Dario Bava and working with Mike, even though the first one was hard for both of us, it became a lot more fun once we got our kind of working method down. And now it's like, we enjoy going back to this world that we're creating together. You know, like it's not just my world. I mean, Mike is now as big a part of look of Professor Dario Bava as any imagined thing. I mean, we've also done video stuff with Professor Dario Bava, and even that's a different thing now than Mike's world. You know, the world that Mike and I are making is now a totally collaborative vision of this original idea that has existed in other forms, but its comic book form is this, you know, commingling of creative forces, you know. And it's really wild to see. And you just have to trust that experience. You can't get too precious or, you know, you got to let things flow to a certain extent, you know, because you also got to, doing sequential storytelling is a lot of work. Takes a long time. You know, we're not super fast, and you know, I've only colored now I think three books, so about four books worth of pages, but you know, three books technically. So you know, I'm not that fast, so we come up with these methods, you know, take manageable chunks. That was the thing too I learned on the first book, is when you dump like 80 pages of script on somebody, it's very easy for them to get like burned out and disillusion, you know, and you're really struggling to get the last pages of the book to look as good as the first pages of the book where they were really excited, you know. That's just normal. I've seen that in several projects now, you know, like, so you learn how to like manage that and make it easier and make it more fun to like, okay, we're going to tackle this chunk, you know, and you start getting the coloring done and showing that to the artist while they're working on inking the next 10 pages. Then they get excited again, you know, like, oh, I love that color palette, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, everybody's engaged, you know.
Yeah. I think we're all, because, you know, most of us, we're all process junkies too. So when we see Like, there's times where I've seen other colors on my art while I'm working on something. And I'm like, oh shit, it looks like a real comic now. You know?
Yeah.
It just gives it just like, oh, okay. We do know what we're doing. Let's keep going.
Yeah. That's the creative process. I mean, that's the fun thing. It's like the piece that whatever you're working on is constantly in the process of becoming what it's going to be. Like, you never, that's the surprise of it. You have to be open to that experience and not try to control it too much, because that's how the great surprises and things that will even shock you as the writer. You'll be like, oh wow, I didn't even make that connection, but the artist saw that and put it in there, and now it's much clearer, and now it's, you know, it's telling the story visually, and I don't have to have another panel of, you know, people over explaining things. So I hate doing that too. I hate having too much, you know, dialogue in a comic in too many panels at once. And, you know, in some books I have to, or in some stories you kind of have to, especially the new Professor Dario Baba book has like a section at the end that, where they are kind of, it's like the famous kind of like, it's almost like a scene in a James Bond movie where they're all gathering around and going over the information and like making a plan. And I made that as fun as I could by intermixing flashbacks and doing a voiceover section. And that way and that's with the help of an artist who's like, yeah, let's not make this, you know, separate panels. This is going to bleed into this image, and this is going to, you know, bleed into this image. And you're like, oh, that's great. Yeah, I can just do like a couple of balloons here, and we just have this beautiful art that's telling this gothic horror backstory. And it all gets conveyed, but it's much more entertaining, and it's done visually versus, you know, a bunch of word balloons. Because I do see that in a lot of modern not a lot, but especially in some smaller indie comics, that they get a little dialogue heavy, and it I think it takes away from it. I feel like I'm watching a sitcom versus reading a comic, but that's a personal taste. But my comics are genre.
Well, we've talked
action and monsters.
we've talked a lot about how you make your comics. So let's talk about the things. Let's talk about Gringo Loco, and let's talk about Professor Dario Baba. For people who are not familiar with them, what's the pitch? What do they need to know?
Well, Professor Dario Baba is an ex-Vatican exorcist in Rome, 1967, who kind of turned on, tuned in, and dropped out of the church to fight monsters with this band of awesome super chicks, Sisters of Tomorrow. Led by Future Chick, a time-traveling hippie from a very bad future. And he's basically an occult investigator who likes to smoke a lot of weed. he likes the ladies. He likes to party. And in Orgy of the Blood Freaks, it's the first like kind of series we're doing with him. He had like, there was a Murder Vibes from the Monster Dimension was the bigger graphic novel we started with, which had origin stories of some of the characters told in an anthology format. But Orgy of the Blood Freaks is about his investigation of this haunted abbey, which is the center of these weird disappearances. And the book opens with him investigating the abbey with his assistant, who is murdered by supernatural forces of psychedelic proportions. And this leads him on an investigation of what's the history of this, you know, abbey, and what's happened here before. It's very fun. It's very like the pacing of it is kind of like a European sort of Eurosleaze movie, as they so undelicately called them at the time, but like almost like a sexy Italian giallo pace, but with monsters and Hammer horror movies influence, which I know a lot of the kids don't probably remember. But back when I was growing up, they had the Hammer horror movies would always be on the creature double feature on the weekends or something, you know, or on midnight, you know, chiller theater or something on TV, on cable TV. And they were these like sexy horror movies, you know, vampire lesbians and, you know, bodice ripping kind of thrillers. It all mixed kind of horror gothic horror elements with sort of sexy adult themes. And that was always something that stuck with me and I loved. And as I got older, I saw more of those types of movies, Jess Franco movies and Dario Argento movies and Mario Bava movies, where I got the name for the lead character, combining those directors' names. And I always wanted to kind of like tell these kind of stories, but tell them in a way that, you know, you pick up the pace, you don't have the budgetary concerns of these low budget kind of drive-in movies. You make them like you would make a James Bond movie. It's like they have that kind of like scope and pace. And it's like all these B movies existing in the same world together. So you've got like werewolf story, you've got time travel, you've got nunsploitation, you've got a black glove killer riding a motorcycle. You've got all these elements that we love in these pulpy stories, but they're in this world together and it all makes sense. Like the Orgy of the Blood Freaks, the first book that's out now, as part of the double issue, is really like the setup story. And we get a lot of, there's a lot of action in it. You know, there's a werewolf fight in it. We got vampires and then we've got, you know, there's just a lot of fun. And then Gringo Loco is kind of my homage to the spaghetti westerns of that same kind of period. It's but mixed with horror. It's sort of a supernatural, we call it a supernatural spaghetti western. And it's kind of been a long sort of germinating idea. I had the idea for the character like 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And it's just taken different forms and I've written out different versions of the story. And I've always wanted to create my own monster, like have a monster that was a main character that we could identify with and that the monster is the anti-hero of the story. And the spaghetti western format of like always the mysterious stranger with a dark past who's, you know, who has some twisted sense of justice, was the perfect kind of, you know, pulp format to put a monster into and make the monster is that character. Monster is the Clint Eastwood. You know, is he the good guy? Is he the bad guy? You know, what's his deal? And it's funny because that book too was one where I had written an entire treatment, an entire story, like the whole backstory of who this guy was before he was a monster, what happened to him, how he became a monster. And I, that all aside, I was like, we're not going to tell that part of the story. We're going to start like 3 months later. Where is he now? What has happened to this guy? And that's how I came up with the concept for the story Deadly and a Dollar Short. I kind of thought of the name as I was thinking of the event that the story takes place basically within a 24-hour kind of period. This guy is hung and, you know, it doesn't really work. And all this, you know, the shit hits the fan, you know, as it does in a Western, you know, pulpy story. And it was really exciting to write like that, where you know everything, but the audience doesn't know anything yet. And to make that story interesting and to get us involved in the character based on purely their actions. We don't know where they came from. We don't know anything about them. We just see what's happening to him moment by moment. It's very existential. It's very like, this happens, you know, and you're left wondering, you know, well, what the hell is this guy? What is this? You know? That was really exciting to write. And because when I got the idea kind of approved by the guys in my company, Diabolic, they heard the origin story, you know, which I explained to them. And you read that and you're like, oh, this has got a lot of themes and it's got a lot of ideas and it's kind of saying this about that. And I was like, it's too obvious. I don't want to even get into that. I want to pull that out in the story over time. I don't want us to learn, you know, because that's kind of the problem that I have with some of the superhero movie stuff, especially the Marvel things where it's like, origin story. We always start with the origin story and then we see what happens, or there's the learning the powers montage and all this stuff. And I thought it'd be just interesting to just plop people into this, you know, story of this guy's life further on, you know, let's just see how it is now and And it's a way to make people sympathize with the character who we're going to learn is, you know, really did have a dark past. And I didn't want to start with the dark past. And people would be like, why do I care about this guy? He's an asshole. So this was a way to kind of do that. And it was great because Vicente understood that immediately. I gave him the script first, and then I gave him the backstory. He loved it from the script. And then he read the backstory, and he's like, oh, wow, this is like, I see what you're doing. You know, and then he got really more excited about, you know, the prospect, because I think he also knew, like, oh, yeah, this book is only one book. Like, there's going to be more to complete the story. So that was a really fun experience. But that's what we put together in the double issue. And the reason we did the double feature was both practical, learning the lesson that you can't overload an artist with too much work. So if you want to release like a 80-page book, you do different. You have more than one artist for one thing, because we were able to turn it over in a year. From script to finished book was, you know, well, with layout and lettering, probably more like 14 months. But it took the first graphic novel took us almost 2 years because it was just so much work all at once. But this, we had two different artists and we were able to tell the two stories, and they're kind of related because Gringo Loco is a character that was peripheral in the earlier Professor Dario Baba book. We see a movie poster on a wall and it's for Gringo Loco.
Nice.
And a character in that book was like cast to be in a movie version of Gringo Loco. So we had kind of already teased it. So it made sense to include them together. And I also like the idea of like a double feature. Like these are two pulpy grindhouse drive-in movie ideas turned up to 11. So you just do them both in the same book as like a double feature. And that's how we kind of came up with the idea to do it that way. Plus I like the idea of a flip.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. Like, I totally get the practicality of it all, but also it's fucking cool to have a flip book.
It's cool.
You know, I've talked about this with numerous friends. Like, we should both do, like, you know, within the same like vein, kind of like this, not like that genre, like you're working in, but like, you know, this stories in the same vein that would go together, and just do a flip book or something. There's another, there's a couple other people I was speaking to, cause I write music and all that. And like, and a couple of the people, they write music and all that. And it's like, we should just like do like a split, like a flip comic and a split EP to accompany.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Oh, that's
and
a great
just
idea.
Like, and just do that. And it's hopefully something I can pull together one day, but yeah. So I really, you know, dug the idea of the flip book and all that. And
it's also like, you can only do that in the physical. Like, we read so much digitally now, even comics, you know, like I read them on a computer, you know, probably almost 70% of the time now, you know, because I get the PDFs or I get, you know, files or on Comixology when that was, I can't get that to work or normally.
Yeah, the latest update is just, it's an atrocity, and I get it to work a little bit, but it's like, it makes the process so much more cumbersome. That
totally.
It's just it almost feels like not worth it. But there's some of the books, and I'm still subscribed to the Comixology Unlimited thing, to where it's like, okay, well, I can still get books on there, but I have to like log on to the website of Amazon, find it, add it to my account, and then go into the it's just a fuck. Anyway,
well, I mean, that's why I like the flip book, because it's like that you can only do that with the physical medium of the book.
And yeah,
I like interacting with the book. You know, like we did a fold out back cover on the first graphic novel, and we did French fold. And then we did a coloring book that the actual inside cover is, you have to destroy the book, rip out the center pages, and then you get a Ouija board, you know, a spirit board. Sorry. Don't want to get a copyright strike. But inside, like, you literally would take out all the coloring book pages. So we told people, you know, you got to get two books because you're going to destroy one. You got to sacrifice one to liberate the spirit board. And it was, I just love that. And we had puzzles in the back too, that were cutouts. There was a planchette for the spirit board, was a cutout in the back with instructions on how to like stick it to a piece of cardboard, you know, use it on your spirit board, you know, It was just really fun because I love the idea of physical media and you know, interacting with it in a way that you can't with digital. Like, that's why you have to have the book, you know, it's because you can't get the full experience without that. And the flip book is just another way of what's our interactive element going to be, you know, and having two covers is awesome. You know, sorry. You
yeah.
know, that's also a cool thing.
You're doubling all the cool aspects of having a comic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that was kind of how the new book came about. We're probably going to do individuals too. We already printed a single issue version of Gringo Loco, and we're going to probably do a single version of Orgy of the Blood Freaks too, for, you know, both for local comic shops and for cons where, mm-hmm. you know, because a double book was more expensive to make, so we have to charge more for it. But if you want to like get people, because it's hard to hook people on to new things, we know that. Mm-hmm. We've had a bunch of new books, and it's an uphill battle to get people engaged. But when you find your audience, they love the stuff. Yeah. So anything to lower the barrier to entry, you know. So the single issues cost less, you know, to get individually.
Yeah.
So that, you know, if you're at the con, you're like, I don't want to spend $24 on this thing, I don't know, but I'll spend $10 on the one, you know. And they're oversized, and we have nice heavyweight, you know.
Also, you know,
cover stock.
As I guess, in the kind of grindhousey family, both of those books are—they're different. You know, they're—you know, someone could like supernatural westerns, and you're like, I don't know about this other stuff. And so you're going to get someone who's maybe like an old Jonah Hex fan or a current Jonah Hex fan or something like that.
Yeah.
Or, and then, you know, there might be someone vice versa where like, oh, I love, you know, all the giallo stuff and all this trippy things going on here, but I don't really care about westerns. Like, so I think it's a very smart move. Also, you know,
ride the coattails, you know, like, cause we'd already done a couple, two, like, Bava type projects, two Professor Dario Bava projects, and we're like, okay, we have a tiny, tiny audience on that. Let's get them hooked on a new thing, but we don't want to do a separate like crowdfunding and a separate marketing for that. Let's just put them together too. That was the other thought, because you would, if you like one, you'll probably like the other. They're very different tones though. Like Bava is more like fun adventure horror monsters. And Gringo Loco is more of a serious, you know, it has some humor in it, but it's dark humor, and it comes from the character of this guy himself, but it still has a monster in it. You know, they're not totally different, but people who've reviewed them have commented that they're both, you know, they're different in tone, they're different, but they're both, they can stand on their own kind of thing. And I just like, you can, when you're doing crowdfunding too, like, it was a little difficult to market this because you're trying to sell people on two things. So we leaned more on the Professor Dario Bava because we figured, well, that's the story that people are already kind of familiar with, that character. Mm-hmm. But it did present a unique challenge to us that I don't know if we met it exactly in terms of like the crowdfunding, the return we got on the crowdfunding. We're hoping that, you know, I want to do it the same way on the next two books. You know, have them piggyback like that. But we'll see how this turns out. We've got to do a couple cons. We're going to be at the Comic-Con Revolution in Ontario, California next weekend. And then we're going to do Monsterpalooza in Pasadena, California, the first weekend in June. And that one, we're going to really see, you know, how people are responding to it.
You're going to have that built-in audience there. And no finer litmus test to see how well is this connecting with everybody.
Know, just to see, people who didn't, you know about it beforehand on social media or didn't support a crowdfunding campaign, they'll see it there and it will get a real because people really respond to the art. The cover art by Emmanuel Taglietti is just spectacular, and it feels like that vintage period because that he's a guy who painted a ton of Italian comic covers back then. So it looks like one of those. And, you know, now he's gotten his reputation has kind of grown. I mean, they sell his like art book collection in Walmart now. If you know Emmanuel Taglietti's work, you're like, wow, I can't believe they actually sell that Walmart. Because a lot of it's like naked chicks and monsters. Monsters coming out of the grave and groping women. It's some of it's a little bit, you know, it's not too PC nowadays, so put it that way. Yeah. But it's hilarious and, you know, it's awesome. Great. Some of the greatest lowbrow horror art ever made. And it's real, so people see that art in the convention setting and it's like that is like a magnet. And then when they come over and flip through the books, you know, we haven't tried the new book yet, but the previous book, they loved it, you know, because it definitely has that vintage feeling. I think my coloring and my lettering is better in the new books. Because I'm just getting better and better at that. But I still love the first one we did, even though it was a much harder project because it was just I went about it all wrong. I love how it came out. You know, it's like I was saying, like you never know what it's going to be till it's done, and then you really have an appreciation for it. You know, it's like that joy of like finishing a thing too. You know, it's like, it's done. Here it is. This is the thing.
Yeah,
perfect, it exists.
So, Phil, it's been a huge blast talking to you about your books. But before we wrap up, you know, I realize it's been a few years, but I have to ask, Metallica being my main all-time number one band, you directed the video for Spit Out the Bone, which is arguably, probably the best Metallica song to come out in the past 20 years.
Yeah, probably. That was my favorite one on that, for sure.
I have a few questions about the process, if you don't mind me picking your brain about it.
No, please.
Just how was the process of getting to do that video? Were you presented with all the tracks? Did they say, no, we want this, you know, we want, you know, your company to do this track, and then they sent you the track and all that? Like, what was the pitch process, the vetting process for that?
Well, I was, you know, basically I got an email from Robert Trujillo, and he was like, hey, Phil, we love your videos. You know, they knew the track that they wanted. They knew they wanted me to do Spit Out the Bone.
Okay.
But they wanted me to do it in the style that I did my High on Fire video and my Torch video and Disturbed video, which is this rotoscope animation style, which I love doing, but it's massively time consuming and it's either you spend a ton of time and a ton of money, or you spend even more time and a little money. So some of those videos, like Monster Magnet video, is the same style. That one, you know, it took 4 months to finish, from start to finish. And these guys had 30 days for me.
Oh boy.
And it's a seven minute video, and they wanted it all animated. 7 minutes is long. That's like two videos. And they wanted it all animated, and they didn't want to perform in it at all. So it's entirely narrative, which you're like, oh, great as a filmmaker. But, you know, the time frame is so short. You almost wish you had performance in it, because then you could focus on just filling the non-performance parts with cool stuff. But no, they wanted a story. So I originally actually turned it down. I didn't want to do it. But my company, you know, the production company Diabolik, you know, my two partners were like, sorry, dude, you're doing it. It's Metallica. We got to do it.
Yeah. We understand, but
exactly, like, it's Metallica. They asked you to do a video. You have to do it. I was like, but the terms, and like, yeah, whatever, because they were doing a video for, it was a double album, and they were doing a video for every song on the album, and it was a very strict delivery schedule. There was no leeway. The most, and they didn't have great budgets either, because they are doing a video for every song on the album. So I had to go in and just, you know, I bargained for a little bit extra money, but it was a really, really difficult project. And I hardly slept in that 30 day period. But it was fun as hell. I mean, we did a sci-fi kung fu video. How great is that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and
I just the great thing was, you know, that you say Metallica. I didn't realize this at first, but you say Metallica to anybody working in any of the, you know, artistic industries surrounding filmmaking and music, and they all want to jump in and do it. And they're all going to put in their, you know, more effort and time, their own money to make everything as awesome as possible. So I didn't realize that going in. But once I started like delegating, I'm like, okay, talk to an animator. I can't do all the animation. You've got to do some of your cool animation for it. And he jumped on it, you know. And then I got to some model makers and I'm like, I need all these props, you know, I need this thing, I need, you know, because I had written the treatment kind of thinking to myself, well, we're going to have to make this like a B movie. It's going to have to be kind of junky, but fun. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to look like a low budget sci-fi movie, kung fu movie, but that's okay. That's how we mean it to look that way. You know, you have to embrace the limitations and, you know, find your zen within the fact that this is what it's going to be. Hopefully everybody gets the joke. You know, I'm actually in the video. I'm the guy who gets zapped by the drone, by the sentry.
I was going to ask if that was you.
Yeah. I get like vaporized and like blasted and turned into a skeleton. That was really fun. But you know, it was great. I had a great time doing it. It was honestly so much work. It was kind of a nightmare, but it was so much fun to work with everybody on that project. And Mindy Kelly, who is the, you know, the kung fu sort of badass of the video. She's like a stunt coordinator that I've worked with before. And she brought in her guys and they were just really helpful because I came up with an idea. The way that video ends was not the original end. It was, you know, where you see her, she's been converted into one of these technomes and she stands there and it's like this very heroic shot where she's like, you know, doing all these like moves. That wasn't really good. The ending was just going to be that they got her and they wheel out the table of electronics and you know that she's going to be turned into a, you know, a robot kung fu, you know, techno monk. But then I was like, that's not enough, you know, because there's also that little riff kick in at the end of the song that's just kind of like the cap on the song. And I'm like, that needs to be like this fast little scene where all of a sudden we see this one last moment. And I thought of it when we only had like a week left in the whole schedule. But I got everybody together. They all agreed to come back in. You know, she came back for like nothing to do it because I told it to her and she was just like, oh my God, that's awesome. We have to do that, Phil. And so the costume designer had to make a costume that fit her for that scene. It was all like this super hectic last minute, but I was really glad that we did it. Cause that's one of my favorite moments in the video is that little piece at the end that really kind of icing on the cake. But, I don't know if I answered your question cause I just rambled.
Answered that and more, you know, you know, just the whole, you know, just I think, you know, especially for me with like Metallica and all that, again, they're like the band I listen to for majority of my life, and so you know, but they're also, it's that weird thing where it's like they're so open with everything, painfully so even, that it's like but you still, there's still like that mythology around things. So like you're just like, Robert Trujillo sent me an email. I'm like, what? Robert actually sent the email, wasn't their management, but you know, it also makes sense with those guys because though they do, at least in my opinion, come across as guys who are like, they're still fans of shit. Like they're still like, you know.
Yeah, totally. They knew my videos. That's how I got the.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, they're not the first, like when I started doing music videos, it was really difficult. I wrote like 45 treatments before I ever got to do a video. And when I finally did one, it was just for a band that I had already worked with on as a photographer, you know, Hailstorm was my first official music label video. And now they're a Grammy award winning band. At the time, it was their debut album. We just got along. And when I wrote a treatment for them, Lizzie Hale was just like, yeah, let's work with Phil. I love that idea. You know, it was just fun. But, you know, as I did more and more videos, it became like, yeah, I didn't have to like compete with other directors at a certain point, because then it was just people like, oh, we want that guy to do a video for us. Because I think what happens is, you know, bands, they'll, you know, especially at different levels, they'll just put out the label will put out a call to different directors. And be, you know, but when a band reaches a certain level, they can pick the director. They can say, I want that guy. I want this guy. And then you become that person. You know, if you can reach that level, then shit like that happens. You just get an email from Robert Trujillo saying, hey man, got this album coming out. You're like, oh my God, is this Metallica? I was pretty jaded by then, but you know, I'm glad we did it, you know, because it was a fun thing to do. It's, you know, I don't think everybody got what, you know, all the limitations that we were dealing with, but I don't worry about that. If it came out, that was fun.
Yeah.
You know,
that does not come across as like, oh, you guys had to, you know, this looks like it took, you know, you guys didn't have a lot of time to do or anything like that. No, it looks, you know, like the vibe you had for it, like it totally comes across as 100% intentional. It is my favorite video from that album. Probably one of my favorite videos of theirs ever. I think it definitely stands out. They were right to pick you for that song. It's not a knock against any other videos that were done for that album. There were some good ones in there. Some good ones in there, and some were, in my opinion, fine. You know, I would never say it was bad because I couldn't do better myself. But you know, that one was definitely, I think, you know, at least from what I remember, the chatter around, like when that song dropped. And the video dropped with it, of course. I think it was for a while, there's kind of like an equal discussion of like, this song is badass, this video is badass, you know, like Metallica's back, like, you know, that kind of like 1, 2, 3 conversation point.
Oh, that's good.
So to hear you talk about it, like, you know, how everyone came together and how rushed it was, it's awesome. It goes back to that collaborative thing. You know, everyone's passionate about it. Everyone's trying to get it done. And sure, it's a little bit easier, I think, for some people to get passionate about a thing when it's the biggest metal band in the world that we've all, like, you know, known.
It definitely helps.
And let's be honest, it doesn't look bad on a resume to say you did this video for Metallica. Now, if it doesn't turn out well, maybe it won't look so great, but you didn't have to worry about that. It's awesome. So thank you for sharing the story and hearing my question.
Thank you, brother. I'm glad you dug it. Appreciate it. A lifelong Metallica fan likes Spit Out the Bone video. That's all I need. I could die a happy man now.
nice. But not yet, because you have plenty more stories to tell, sir. So again, thank you for coming on. A special thanks to Melissa Mazaris for hooking us up together. So we can do this. She's the best. It was a blast talking to you. I'm going to definitely have to ask you to come back. We got so much more we can talk about.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I would love to.
We barely scratched the surface, I think. And I'm sure this is far from your last comic being released.
No, I'm working on more now.
You see? So definitely, Phil, I can't wait to have you back. Thank you so much for your time. Could you let everybody know where they can find you? I'll make sure there's links to all your stuff in the show notes, but for social media, let everybody know where they can find you.
Yeah, I'm at Phil Mucci on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. I think I'm Phil _Mucci. And Diabolic Films is our other social media. And for the books and everything, go to ProfessorDarioBava.com. And you can get a bunch of cool stuff and merch. There's actually a movie poster I made for Metallica Spit Out the Bone on there. I'll have to send you one.
Awesome. Phil, again, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure, man.
Links to all the stuff will be in the show notes. Go follow Phil, check out his books. And yeah, there we go.
Thank you for listening to the Comics Talking Metal Podcast. Please be sure to return next episode with my guest, the immensely talented Daniel Warren Johnson. See you then.